Welcome to Exponential Technology Council. I'm your host, Jürgen Wallrath, and I'll be introducing you to disruptive technologies from around the world. The people working at research institutes in universities and startups that are redefining our future. So join me every week as we explore these latest innovations. Hello and welcome to Exponential Technology Council. Today I've got someone really cool on the show. Even if you haven't seen the movie RoboCop, you probably know what a cyborg is though. It's a human enhanced with non-biologic components. Besides, who doesn't dream about enhancing their own brain with computer chips? Well, I have with me today Dr. Steve M. Potter, who's probably as close as you'll get to making such dreams a reality with his work in studying the brain and brain-machine interfacing. Until recently, he was associate professor at Georgia Tech, and before that, Caltech, where he taught neurobiology and neuroengineering to undergraduate and graduate students. And since 1999, he ran a research lab dedicated to understanding the brain at the networks level, using living neural cultures interface to computers. He made tools for neuroscientists to study neural tissue. Hello and welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Jürgen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I understand that it all started for you during your grad school days when you decided that if you want to watch learning actually happening in front of your eyes in a living brain, the best way to do it was to actually have the neurons that control the various body parts sitting still in front of you. And that wasn't always an easy task. So tell us about this project. How do you study neuron activity in the brain without movements by the other body parts interfering with your studies?
Yeah, so at the time, which was around 1993, I was really excited about these conferences called the Simulation of Adaptive Behavior, and their proceedings were called Animals to Animats. And an animat is a simulated animal. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool to have a simulated animal that was controlled by an actual living brain? And so I came up with this idea of a hybrid neural system, or what we call a hybrot, which is a piece of living tissue growing in a culture dish that's wired up and connected with a two-way connection to a computer that's running an animal simulation. And eventually that simulation was an actual robot, a physical robot that could move around and serve as the body of this hybrid while its brain would hold still on the microscope where we can watch the neurons growing and making connections and doing their thing.
Now, I want to actually cover two things, because we spoke earlier on and you sketched some of the projects you've been working on. So I'm going to start with a more serious one, the real-life application. We spoke about helping people with certain disabilities, and I understand you've done a fair amount of work in the area of epilepsy and potentially finding a cure that is less invasive than is currently done, which is removing a substantial chunk of a patient's temporal lobe. If you could just go into that in a little more detail.
Yeah, so I was interested in the basic science of learning and memory, and my lab was trying very, very hard to get these culture dishes to learn something, but they were undergoing seizures all the time. It turns out that neural tissue, when you cut off its inputs, like you do when you put it in a culture dish and stick it in the incubator, it tends to become hyperexcitable, and this is probably the cause of lots of different types of seizure disorders, chronic pain, tinnitus or ringing in the ears, and other disabilities where the input has been cut off and the tissue becomes a little bit too twitchy and hyperexcitable. So this was the problem with our culture dishes. We couldn't get them to learn because they were having seizures, and we said, we need to solve this problem. And we did it by using distributed electrical stimulation through the substrate that the cells were growing on. We would zap them with tiny little sparks of electricity, sort of like sprinkling onto the culture, only little electric impulses, and giving it some sort of a background input that would be there. And that immediately stopped these bursts of activity from happening. And we then have worked with Bob Gross at Emory University to test this idea out in rats, and it has helped them substantially with reducing seizures. And one of my former graduate students, Sharanya Desai, is now working for NeuroPace in the Bay Area to try to translate this into a device that's implanted into people.
So if I understand you correctly, it basically just creates background stimulation of the neurons and thereby avoids them going into hyperdrive and overreacting?
That is exactly right. So it circumvents this homeostatic tendency of brain tissue. It's expecting inputs. It's not getting inputs, so it's constantly turning up the volume. And if at some point it goes unstable, and that's when the seizures start happening.
Uh-huh.
So if you give it some background input all the time, it will never get to that state.
Right. Now, I said I was going to touch on a slightly lighter note in a second, and I wanted to talk about the artistic element in all of this, namely two projects you worked on that you referred to as MEART or M-E-A-R-T and Silent Barrage. Just tell us a little more about those two.
Yes. So these were actually where this idea of helping the seizures came from. Believe it or not, our art science collaborations led to this clinical application that we weren't even planning on getting into. So we have this long-term collaboration with Guy Benari and Phil Gamblin, who work at the University of Western Australia in Perth, and they are part of a research unit called Symbiotica, where people come and do art projects that involve science. And they had made this robot that draws on big sheets of paper, and they said, wouldn't it be cool to try controlling that with one of your culture dishes of neurons? And I said, yeah, that would be really cool. That was around 2001, and we started this collaboration, and we made it happen. And because they're in Perth, which is exactly on the other side of the globe from Australia, from Atlanta, where our lab was, that we usually had to work in the middle of the night. And so they bought us a couch to sleep on for our lab. So they built this robot, and it basically went on tour to art galleries all over the world, being controlled by a living brain, which consisted of a culture dish of neurons in our lab, over the internet. And there was a two-way communication link that we set up between the robots doing the drawing and the brain tissue. And the signal coming back to our lab was from video cameras watching the drawing in progress. So as this thing, MEART, drew, it got to see what it was drawing, and then it would send stimuli back to the network to stimulate it and hopefully learn how to draw better. The result, in my opinion, was still toddler-level artistic ability of scribbles mostly, but the artists loved it.
So, in effect, you had not only a human organic brain controlling a machine, and that's why I made that reference to cyborg earlier on. In this particular case, you actually created that brain, or you grew that brain in a culture dish. So you basically took one step further.
It was rats that donated the brain tissue, not humans, but it could have been. You know, we have, as I mentioned, I have a collaborator at Emory who routinely removes parts of people's brains, and they have offered human brain tissue to us if we needed it.
Now, Silent Barrage took it a step further, I take it.
Yeah, the Silent Barrage was this MEART version 2, and instead of one robot drawing on a sheet of paper, it was a whole room full of these pillars that were drawing on the pillars, and about 30, I think it was 36 pillars, and each of them had a robot that would move up and down the pillar and spin around, and it was controlled by neurons in the dish, and it was sort of a one-to-one mapping of electrodes to these robots, and as the viewers at the gallery walked through the exhibit, the camera was watching them, and their position would send stimuli back to the network in our lab. So they could see the network responding in terms of the way the robots were moving as they moved through the exhibit. So there was an intimate connection between them and the brain tissue in some sense.
So you basically had a closed loop internet connection. The brain was stimulated by what the video showed it and reacted to that, and then appeared on the machinery on the other side of the planet.
That's right. And this thing toured all over the place to Dublin, Ireland, and Sao Paulo, Brazil, and somewhere in Bilbao, Spain, to Moscow, all these different places.
Now, have there been any more practical applications of that, the actual brain-machine interfacing, specifically your work?
Yeah, we we noticed that when the culture dish was hooked up to Mayart for a month at a time during a longer exhibit, that the culture dish quieted down, that the seizures that were happening were going away. So in some sense, that was the first example by accident of this approach that we then perfected to try to reduce the seizures in our cultures. And it did allow them to learn. Eventually, in 2008, we published a paper in which we successfully managed to train a culture dish to control an animat in a navigation task. And we used complicated patterns of electrical stimulation to do the training to get the synaptic weights to change so that the network would then control the thing properly. And all of that was required us to have these seizure-like bursting patterns under control.
Now, where do you actually, and that's sort of probably my final question to you, is where do you see the future of AI? Because it is related to artificial intelligence. So based on your earlier work, I'd guess it probably involves some kind of combination between biologic tissue and machines. But give us your opinion of where things are going.
Yeah, I think the thing that a lot of people forget is that we have an existence proof for a fantastic intelligent machine right between our ears. We don't need to invent some wacky new technology like quantum computing in order to do this. We can just try to figure out how natural neural systems compute. Now, I said digital computers are good for computing certain types of things, long columns of numbers, you know, and that sort of thing where absolute precision is very important. But neural systems are really good at computing real-time tasks, situations where you have to interact with the real world in real time. You have a lot of constraints, you have a lot of inputs, a lot of sensors, and a lot of actuators. Neural systems are very good at controlling those things, coming up with computations very quickly that are useful in the real world. So in cases, for example, let's just take self-driving cars. You know, that's a hot topic right now. This is an ideal situation where a neural controller seems appropriate to me. And currently they are being controlled by neurons that are human drivers in the cars. So if we're going to design the ideal artificial intelligence to do things like self-driving cars, we ought to look to neural systems. Now, there's a couple ideas you could do. You could say, okay, let's just write a computer program that sort of emulates the way that we think the brain works. I think that's a great first step. The next step would be to make actual hardware that emulates the way the brain works. For example, silicon devices that use not just ones and zeros, but all of the values in between, sort of analog computing that Carver Mead has pioneered long, long ago. So that'd be a good next step. And then the third step, and it's a rather large step, would be to use actual living tissue as the computational element. The advantage of using living neural tissue is that you don't necessarily need to know how it works. You can electrically train the tissue to accomplish a certain task. It will rewire itself. It evolves to be a learning device, and it can learn to do a presumably infinite variety of tasks and control situations. So that might be the AI of the future, some sort of hybrid system that includes living neural tissue.
Now, what about the other aspect that I mentioned where you actually use the human brain and enhance it? If you already have an interface between brain and machine, do you ever see that happening where you're supplementing either your memory capacity or your computational capacity using external chips?
Yes. The first thing I would say is that we already have very good interfaces to the brain, which are our hands, eyes, and ears. And it's going to be a long time before electrical interfaces or presumably optical and optogenetic interfaces are better than those. However, there are people like Ted Berger at USC that are already making great progress with some kind of a cognitive prosthesis, some sort of a chip that would interface with the brain electrically and serve the purpose of replacing a damaged part of the brain, for example, like the hippocampus. Now, the big problem is bandwidth. You know, neurons are very high bandwidth creatures. They often have thousands of inputs per cell, for an individual cell to get thousands of different inputs. And there's millions of neurons working on every little job that the brain might be doing, if not billions. So bandwidth is a problem. And I think if we're going to talk about future interfaces, they probably are going to be optical. That means that you would make the neurons light sensitive by genetically engineering them and putting light-sensitive proteins into them. And you would also put some kind of an optical indicator in them genetically that would be able to be read out with light. So you shine light on the cells, and the way that it bounces back or fluoresces tells you something about the activity in the neuron. So a two-way optical connection with feedback is where I see these neural interfaces going, and that would facilitate a more high bandwidth interface to the brain that might augment our cognition, serve as an external memory, or allow us to be connected to each other in a more intimate way than we are now.
One last thing that occurred to me, since you've managed to essentially grow brain cells in a culture dish, do you believe it's possible, insofar as people have suffered brain damage of sorts, either through a stroke or physical trauma, that you could be supplemented with their own tissue by regrowing some of the cells and then planting it back into their brain?
Yeah, I think this has actually been tried to help people recover from things like Parkinson's disease. They took neural tissue from the adrenal glands and put them into there. The problems you have to worry about are that tissue might grow uncontrollably and become a brain tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And growing cells into neural tissue is really moving along now. And I suspect that this is going to be quite doable in the next 10 or 15 years, that we'll be able to take a piece of tissue, differentiate it into neural tissue in vitro, and then put it back in the brain where it can serve as a blank slate to be reconnected up to the existing tissue and learn. You know, it would have to be retrained. It would be pretty far in the future to imagine having pre-trained tissue implanted in the brain and having it hook up correctly. I think it'd be much easier to put, you know, basically embryonic tissue and have it learn just from being in a new context what its job is.
Steve, I want to thank you for coming on the program today, because it's I find it fascinating what you're working on. More importantly, it gives me some kind of context on what is reality, what is really happening at the moment. In other words, something that is different from what Hollywood or what my own imagination would try and tell me is possible. I now have a real sense of where the technology is at this point and where it's likely to end up. So I wish you all the best in your future endeavors. I mentioned at the beginning that you have just left the university scene and have struck out on your own. The entrepreneurial spirit obviously is grabbing you. And so I'm very excited to hear what happens, and I'm hoping that maybe we could at some point have a follow-up interview just to talk about what your latest projects are.
Yeah, that would be my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, you have a wonderful weekend, and we'll touch base again.
Okay, thank you.
And to the rest of you, that's the end of today's podcast. I wish you a wonderful week and hope to see you next time. You have been listening to Exponential Technology Council with me, Jürgen Wollrath. Remember to visit me on my website at www.etcouncil.com, and I will see you next week.